A novel imagines the life of a queen of the Ottoman Empire.
The openings for the writer of historical fiction are in the areas where little is known. And this is what made Nurbanu such a wonderful subject for a novel, because very little is known about her.
That's Catherine Nouri Hughes. Her novel, The Mapmaker's Daughter, tells the story of a remarkable historical figure of the 16th century, Queen Mother Nurbanu. We also get advice from book publicist Claire McKinney on how to promote your book. That's all coming up on today's Writer's Voice. Thanks for joining us this hour on this station and at writersvoice.net. I'm your host, Francesca Rhiannon. Historical fiction always faces the challenge of getting the details right about the time and place of its setting, even more so when little is known about the main character in question. But one thing Catherine Nouri Hughes could be confident about the protagonist of her novel, The Mapmaker's Daughter, is that she was an extraordinary woman. Nurbanu, who according to Hughes' story is born into a wealthy Christian Venetian family, is captured as a slave and brought to the court of Suleiman the Magnificent. There she rises to become the most powerful woman in the Ottoman Empire, at its apex. Queen Mother Nurbanu is lying on her sickbed at the end of her life when she decides to write the spectacular story of her rise to the pinnacle of imperial power, to understand the causes and effects of her loves and choices. Was she right to elevate the needs of the empire over the needs of her own family and even herself? Catherine Nouri Hughes has published 2 books on K-12 education and was a communications executive in the for-profit and non-profit sectors. She got her master's degree in Near Eastern Studies from Princeton University. The Mapmaker's Daughter is her first novel. Well, Catherine Nouri Hughes, welcome to Writer's Voice.
Thank you. It is a pleasure to be here.
This book, The Mapmaker's Daughter, it takes place in the Ottoman Empire several hundred years ago. I wonder, before we go really into the meat of the book, give us the historical context, not just of the Ottoman Empire, but also Venice, because that also plays an important role in the book.
Thank you. I'm happy to do that. The official contours of the story are the birth and death dates of my character, Cecilia Baffo Veniero, born Venetian, born in 1525, and she died in 1583. The Venice of this period is really, like the Ottoman Empire of the same period, is Venice at its height and the Ottoman Empire at its height. This is not a trivial fact in the book. Both the Republic and the Empire felt themselves at that height. Venice was on the front edge of map making, of navigation, of shipbuilding, of printing. They were in the process of building the world's first ghetto for Jews, not exactly enlightened, but it corresponds in time exactly to the opposite treatment in the Ottoman Empire of Jews. This figures in the story. This is a little bit after Magellan, just to put it in your listener's mind, a little before Henry VIII on the other side of Europe. The time of Francis I in France, of Charles V, the Holy Roman Emperor. So 1525, she's born. In 1492, you know, hardly at all before, was the expulsion of the Jews from the Iberian Peninsula. Where do they go? They go to the Ottoman Empire, because the grandfather of Suleiman the Magnificent sends the Ottoman navy to pick them up, because he sees them for the asset that they are and will be.
That's a great framing. Really, the beginning of the Age of Discovery in terms of the Christian world, and the real flowering of, not the first flowering, but a very important flowering of the Arabic world.
Well, I think it was flowering long before then, but please keep in mind, I'm not an historian. I did a great deal of research for this, but my strong impression is that the Arab world was flowering many centuries before this. It is thanks to Arabs that, for example, the writings of Ptolemy, who basically put together the world's first atlas, which contained projections but not the drawings of maps, Ptolemy was translated from Greek into Arabic in the 9th century. It was only in the 1400s that it got translated into Latin. Had it not been translated into Arabic from the Greek, we probably wouldn't have access to Ptolemy as we did in the Renaissance. It's absolutely as a result of the enlightenment of Arabs and of Islamic science.
And you mentioned maps, so talk about the connection. I mean, this is the mapmaker's daughter, and first of all, we should say she is the daughter of a woman who was a mapmaker. Talk about the significance of maps in this historical context, and then let's get introduced to our character.
This is about two generations into the real thrust forward in maps in Europe and in the East. It's at the very moment of the greatest of all Islamic map makers named Piri Reis. There's a little frontispiece in the book by Piri Reis, who wrote an absolutely fantastic three-volume book on, it's called The Book of the Sea. And to look at his maps makes it clear that they are their notions of place, their feelings about place, as much as they are visual instructions of how to get there. Maps of the time include images of angels and strange-looking creatures blowing like wind, and they were meant to summon up all kinds of spirits and assets of whoever the donor or the underwriter of the map-making project was. Venice was very big on map-making because of its navigational expertise and its strategic location, and ditto with the Sublime Port, which is the other name for Istanbul.
The Sublime Port?
Yes.
What an amazing name.
Yes, P-O-R-T-E, it's a French term. It's kind of like Foggy Bottom, referring to the State Department. It's actually a place. There is this Sublime Port, but it's how Istanbul, as the capital of the Ottoman Empire, came to be known as the Sublime Port.
Now, isn't Istanbul Constantinople?
No, it's not. After 1453, that's when it changes. That is when Mehmed the Conqueror took Constantinople finally, and the Byzantine Empire ceased to exist. And that's when he rode on his steed into Hagia Sophia and turned the basilica into a mosque by virtue of doing that. So, yeah, it's often called Constantinople up until 1923 with Ataturk, but really, officially, it ceased to be that, and officially was Istanbul after 1453.
So now, tell us about your character, Nurbani, you know, where she came from, and also, was she a real person? Because we're talking here in The Mapmaker's Daughter by my guest, Catherine Nouri Hughes. We're talking about a novel, so this is a work of fiction, historical fiction. How much is fiction? How much is history?
I can't answer that in terms of a percentage. So let me tell you how it's constructed so your listeners can infer what they will from it. The first thing to say is that in the term historical fiction, the operative word is fiction. One cannot mess with facts, of course. Dates of birth, dates of rebellions and wars and the like. The openings for the writer of historical fiction are in the areas where little is known. And this is what made Nurbanu such a wonderful subject for a novel, because very little is known about her. We know lots more about Suleiman the Magnificent, who figures very prominently in the story, and his son and his grandson. I mean, tons have been written about all of them, but very little about her. So would you like me to tell you the little we know about her?
Absolutely.
Born in 1525, we're not exactly sure where, but it could have been on the island of Paros, and for my purposes, that is where I have her born. we are sure she would have been conceived in Venice, of patrician parents who, very importantly, were not married to each other. She was raised in a very rarefied atmosphere and household. She had an exceptionally, or plausibly would have had, an exceptionally fine education. I infer from her patrician background that she would have, well, we know that Venetian girls of the time had educations that were every bit as good as their brothers. This is true in Venice and in Padua. And so these kids, you know, when they're 10 and 12 years old, they can read in Latin and Greek. They know trigonometry. They know astronomy. This is not unusual.
Could you say why? Why girls as well as boys? What's different about Venice?
Venice was an enlightened place. I don't know the exact answer, but I can imagine that it has to do with its strategic location, where, you know, it looks both east and west. It truly straddles those environments. And, you know, the Ottomans weren't unenlightened on the subject of women either. That is precisely why Nurbanu was able to rise to the height of power that she did. Was she inside of a system that was tight and that confined women? You bet. But were there ways of an enterprising, extremely smart, directed woman to rise to the top? Yes, yes, there were. And she took advantage of them.
And so she was given the opportunity to do that in a very traumatic way, however.
Well, yes. So you ask about what is fact and what is fiction. It took me a long time to write the book. I don't know if this is of interest to your listeners, but it took 20 years. I started 20 years ago with the research at the suggestion of Bernard Lewis, who was a thesis advisor at Princeton.
And a great scholar of the Ottoman Empire.
Absolutely, one of the greatest, and alive still at 101. And over the years, I wrote many, many drafts of this book, and the first several were actually chronologies of her life. They weren't a novel. They didn't have a story. They had interesting events, and they had extremely interesting events, but it took me a long time, and with the help of a lot of rejections, to learn that there was something essential missing. I found that something about a third of the way through the 20 years when I was once again noodling around in the Encyclopedia of Islam, really kind of just trying to get my bearings again. And I found in the entry on Murad III, Nurbanu's son, that when he took the throne and the law of fratricide, which had been put in place by Mehmed the Conqueror in 1453, that law was carried out and his half-brothers were put to death, and it happened against his will. Now, what it doesn't say in the Encyclopedia of Islam is who gave the order. And when I saw that, I thought, this is my opening. This is an extremely important thing that happened. Somebody other than the Sultan himself gave the order for his half-brothers to be killed.
Explain the law of fratricide here, and then why would this be such an important fulcrum for you to build your novel, The Mapmaker's Daughter, around?
The Ottoman Empire begins in 1299. I can't tell you specifically in years, but for the first part, the matter of succession was basically determined by contenders duking it out in one way or another. And there were civil wars, and they were very costly in terms of the power of the empire. Mehmed the Conqueror wanted to put an end to how hard it was on the dynasty to keep fighting it out among themselves. And he put in place the law of fratricide, which it was absolutely to prevent chaos and to prevent internal competition and to assure the duration of the dynasty. And the thinking was that the lives of the many, thinking of it as a collective, is worth more than the lives of a very few. Does it seem okay to kill little boys or bigger boys or grown brothers? No, it's ghastly. But the thinking was, at least it avoids civil war. And it did.
And you're talking about killing all the brothers and half-brothers of the one who was chosen to succeed.
Yes, either chosen or who had worked his way to the vanguard position, crucially, almost always with the help of his mother. Because it's the mothers that had the greatest, who looked after the interest of the princes, and they had a great deal to do with whether they succeeded or not. And Nurbanu was not only not an exception to this, she was a prime example of this. I'm going to veer off and just cite the so-called Sultanate of Women. This is a moment of about four generations of women who were particularly successful in advancing the interests of their prince sons so that they could accede to the throne.
And she was the first?
No, she was the second. She was preceded by a very well-known consort who becomes a wife, the wife of Suleiman the Magnificent, and her name was Hürrem in Turkish and Roxolana in Europe. And a lot is known about her, unlike Nurbanu. But in fact, there's very little known about any of these women, just like there's very little known about what went on inside of the harem, because harem means forbidden in Turkish. And what was forbidden wasn't the sex that goes on there. That's not what it was about. What was forbidden was access. So these women gained access, and this was extremely important to their rise. The law of fratricide lapsed after two generations after Nurbanu, and it was replaced. This is beyond, of course, the scope and the time of the book, but it was replaced by a convention within Topkapi Palace called the Cage. And after that, princes were incarcerated, and it was kind of like a glamorous incarceration, and it was brutal. But princes were no longer executed.
They were kept within the palace.
Kept within the palace, and they were sexless, useless. Oh, it was terrible. No, it was just, it was ghastly. But that is beyond the time of the book. So back to your question, why does fratricide matter to Nurbanu's story?
And actually, first, how did Nurbanu come to be in the position she was?
So just quickly, back to 1525, she's born. She's educated in Venice. She's raised as a little girl on the island of Paros in Greece. She goes to Venice. She receives her education there. She goes back to Paros when she is 12 years old after the death of her mother, the map maker, who had an enormous influence on her. And so she was 12 when her beloved mother died. She is captured when she's 12 by Turkish corsairs and taken up to Istanbul and put into the harem when she is 12. Suleiman is sitting on the throne. He's been there at that point maybe 12, 15 years. He's enormously powerful. He's got several sons. He, in time, will have one of them executed as a grown man. Another one will be led into a battle that Suleiman knows his son won't win. And my contention is that he wants his weakest son to succeed him because he himself is scared to death of being toppled by his son. Suleiman's own father killed everybody around him. I mean, it was really brutal. Suleiman's father killed all of his brothers, and he killed all of his sons except for Suleiman. And this made a big impression on Suleiman. So when it came his time, he wanted a son who was going to get the job done, but when he succeeded him, but who wasn't going to topple him, Suleiman, en route to being Sultan himself. So keeping in mind Suleiman's desire to have his weakest son succeed him, when this girl, Cecilia, shows up as booty, along with golden chalices and horses and all the other stuff that was scooped up on these raids around the Mediterranean basin, she's presented with all the other girls that have been stolen from their families. She's not only beautiful, but keep in mind, she's 12. And she's identified by her patrician father's name, which Suleiman recognizes. But it is brought to his attention very quickly that this girl has arrived with a really razzle-dazzle education. And he identifies her very quickly as the one he is going to assign to the weak son that he intends to have succeed him, because he perceives that she can compensate for that.
What a story. So now she does, when Suleiman dies and her husband ascends to the Sultanate, she comes into a great position of power. So now tell us why this law of fratricide is so much a pivot to the book, because it really brings in a kind of moral question and dimension.
Yeah, it most certainly does. I mean, the Cecilia Nurbanu, in my mind, is a deeply moral person. She has a very venal father who dies early, and a very vain, venal grandfather. She has a moral compass, which she inherits from her mother. I mean, she knows weak, spineless men when she sees them. And she knows that Suleiman is not one of them. She doesn't think it. She believes it. And she has a lot of reason to. And it's not just because he has created the world's greatest, vastest empire at that time. He's promulgated a code of secular law. He's championed the arts. He's built a system of schools. He commissions mosques and bridges and roads, and he is an enlightened, and he sponsors the sciences, and he is an enlightened person. She infers from this that he is a moral man. Cecilia has a fundamental guiding need to belong, and it derives from the fact that she's illegitimate. It's a big tangle in her mind, what her father was like, how her father betrayed her mother, how her mother stayed on her feet. All of this made a big impression on her as a girl. So she arrives in Istanbul with a very clear sense of what it is to belong, in sort of in theory, and what it feels like not to belong. Suleiman, because he develops a relationship with her, and I want to stress there is absolutely nothing romantic or sexual or weird about it. He sees her for the extremely special young, she's not a young woman, she's a girl, that she is. And over time, after he does assign her to his son, who will succeed him, it becomes clear to him that she has this need for legitimacy. And when he marries her to his son, he understands that he is conferring something on her that is not of passing importance to her. It's hard to carry out wishes posthumously. Mm-hmm. It doesn't matter what era we live in, right? That's a dicey thing to count on.
Unless you're Hamlet's father.
Unless you're Hamlet's father. Suleiman is concerned that when his son dies, he knows that when he dies, the weak son that he wants to succeed him will succeed because he's taken care of everybody else. There's no other son left. So he knows that the weak son, Selim, married to Nurbanu, will succeed. What he can't guarantee is whether Nurbanu's son, Suleiman's grandson, whom he adores, will succeed. The reason Suleiman adores him is because Nurbanu has raised Murad in the image of her mother. She's educated him the way her mother educated her. He's an enlightened kid, and he becomes an enlightened youth. And Suleiman loves him, and Suleiman gets that the empire cannot be taken any farther than it is. It has been taken. It's reached its geographic limits. It literally actually did on his watch. And he knew that for many reasons, but the apparatus of government went with these guys when they went out to push frontiers on their campaigns, and it was simply not sustainable anymore. Therefore, to expand the empire's glory, which he was determined to have happen posthumously, it had to be done in a different domain, the domain of science and of imagination, of navigation, of astronomy. I'll say it three times. And this has astronomy, because this has to do with the observatory that is built in Istanbul on the watch of Nirbanu's grandson. Suleiman wants his beloved, beautifully educated, highly moral grandson to succeed. And Suleiman is certain that, left to his own devices, that Murad, when it is time for him to accede to the throne, Suleiman knows that he won't give the order to have his half-brothers killed. He knows he won't, because he's been raised by his mother to be the way he is. But Suleiman thinks that the way he can get the order to be carried out is by asking Murad's mother, Nirbanu, to do it. You know, kind of like as a real favor to me.
Please kill the half-brothers.
You know that this law exists. You know, I'm him talking to her, right? It exists for a reason. You understand that. You understand how the empire works. You're just outstanding in every way. I spotted you when you were young, and I wasn't wrong. I mean, look what you've turned into. Look at the kind of kids you've raised. Look how wonderful you were to my son, to whom you're married, who's kind of a mess, but you're a great wife to him. But best of all, you've raised this fabulous son, Murad. And the only way to hold this dynasty together is by making sure that this law is carried out. I can count on no one but you to do this.
A difficult thing for a woman of her character and of her background, which after all, you know, was as a, you know, upper middle class Venetian girl, you know, not accustomed to these kinds of palace intrigues. So, Catherine Nuri Hughes, you also mentioned how important a role is played by the whole position of Jews in the Ottoman Empire. And that also is part of the theme of the book. I wonder if you could bring that in.
We talked earlier about Bayezid, Suleiman's grandfather, sending the Ottoman fleet to the Iberian Peninsula in 1492. Now, obviously, there were, or maybe it's not obvious, but there were plenty of Jews in Anatolia before the European Jews arrived after 1492. There were Persian-speaking Jews and Arabic-speaking Jews, but it was this influx of European Jews that made a big difference. They brought with them their artistry, their knowledge of banking, of printing, and, you know, they were great traders in jewels. There were those from Antwerp who also came to the empire, and those from Venice, and they were great agents, like, you know, those liminal characters in the Uptop Kapı Palace who would serve as go-betweens between the inside and the outside. And one of them figures prominently in the story, a woman. Her name is Esther. There really was an Esther. Esther Handali, who was really married to a rabbi, who stayed behind in Venice when she came to the empire, probably a bit before Nirbanu arrived. And she becomes very important to Nirbanu's. She's not an alter ego, but it is she who encourages Nirbanu at the end of her life, because this is a deathbed account. It is Esther who says, you know, you've got to sort some things out here. You're really sick. We don't know if you're going to die or not, but maybe you ought to write your life down and see. It'll help you make sense of things. Nobody was as close to Nirbanu as Esther was. Nobody else could have said such a thing to her. So they had a very close personal relationship. And Nirbanu was quite dependent on her in certain ways. She's a very independent woman, but
Catherine Nuri Hughes. We'll talk more about her novel, The Mapmaker's Daughter, after the break. Welcome back to Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. We're talking with Catherine Nuri Hughes about her debut novel, The Mapmaker's Daughter. It's about the life of the most powerful woman living at the peak of the Ottoman Empire, Queen Mother Nirbanu. Well, let me ask you, here you have Esther, a powerful woman. You have Nirbanu, a powerful woman, and Nirbanu's mother, who also was. I think, you know, the image that so many Americans have of Islam is that it, you know, keeps women in Purda, you know, shut away from everything, they have no rights, etc. So I wonder if you could talk about, through your historical research, as you were doing this research into these women, and of course there's a lot of gaps there, so you had to create a lot, but no doubt you got a sense of what women's position was at this time in this empire and in Venice as well. So what were your thoughts? What did you discover that surprised you or, you know, kind of enriched the story in your mind about the position of women in these cultures?
Well, of course, there's a big difference between how women operated in Venice and in the Ottoman Empire. But they had much more running room, I think, in all departments. Although, you know, it was very stratified. There was a very tight class system in the Venetian Republic at the time. But women, well, as I said, patrician women and girls were very highly educated. So there's that. In the Ottoman Empire, the rank and file woman wasn't free at all. She had really no say at all in anything that happened. I mean, period. End of sentence. But if you were inside the royal household, and if you had caught the eye of the sultan, and especially if you had produced a son, a prince, because daughters were only could take you so far, then if you were enterprising, there were clear, well, maybe not so clear, there were avenues for advancement. Hürrem, Suleiman's wife, Nurbanu's mother-in-law, found hers. Nurbanu found hers. Far from pulling up the ladder after her, when she became, Nurbanu's power really kicked in as queen mother. She had plenty of power when she was married to the sultan, Selim, the weak one that Suleiman had her compensate for. But when Murad acceded to the throne, that's when, among other things, Topkapi Palace was enormously expanded in a huge building project. Maybe some of your listeners have been there. The most beautiful, really glorious parts of the harem were built on Nurbanu and Murad III's watch. But more importantly, to answer this question, she put in place a meritocracy that did not exist at all. She wanted girls and women to be able to rise. And she made it very clear, the opportunities, the avenues. It didn't depend on whether you were liked by the superintendent of the harem or not. You know, if you did well, you got promoted. And you could get promoted to positions actually of considerable wealth. So it wasn't, as a woman, absolutely. So it wasn't just that you were no longer doing laundry. It's that you actually could amass considerable wealth and support a family outside.
And this is historically true, or?
This is historically true. And for any of your readers who's interested in more on this, Leslie Pierce is the source on the subject, the Imperial Harem. She's, no one knows more than she does about this.
Yeah, and so this brings me, I guess, to my final question. This book took you 2 decades to write, and kudos to you for sticking with it. Talk a little bit also about the process, the research in this book. Like, how did you find out about Nurbanu? And what was possibly the most difficult aspect of the research and the most surprising?
There was very little to find out about Nurbanu. I mean, the task with Nurbanu was imagining. I mean, it didn't not involve research, because what I had to do was infer from available things what she would have been like. For example, the fact that girls had good educations. Then I could derive from that attributes. The most surprising thing about writing the book actually didn't have to do with research. The research was contained. Bernard gave me a gigantic syllabus. It took me 2 years to read. You know, it was just, there it was. What was really difficult and eye-opening was making the two time frames in which the book is told work. There are two arcs. Because it is a end-of-life account, she's lying there on her bed, writing on her parchment. This goes on for 30 days, roughly. And she's recalling her 58 years of life while she's lying there in those 30 days. As she gets sicker on the short arc of day 1 to day 30, her insights grow clearer. and her willingness to be truthful on the page is stronger. So she edits what she's remembering. So she'll remember one thing, and this often has to do with excusing Suleiman. So, you know, early in the first days of lying there recalling, she's making excuses for Suleiman. And then as the days go on and she's telling the story, she progresses in the years of the long arc, but she also progresses in her, you know, as you get sicker, you see things more clearly. You're just not willing to expend energy on dissembling. And that's what happens to her. And making those two arcs work in the writing process was really tricky. But it was extremely rewarding. I mean, it just, every time it kind of worked, it just yielded up lots of information about each of these characters when the two arcs kind of bumped up against each other. And then I have to say that there's a third arc that functioned in all of this, and it wouldn't have had this book taken less than 20 years to write, and that's the arc of my own life. You know, if I had written it in 3 years, I don't think it would count as an arc. But I changed a lot over the course of writing this. I mean, I was middle-aged when I started this, and I'm on Medicare now. You know, I didn't have grandchildren when I started, and now my grandson drives a car. The grandson in the book, I couldn't have written about that boy as I do without knowing my grandson and loving him as I do. And other very big, important things have happened in my own life that informed, well, that allowed me to know certain things.
Do you want to say more about that?
Yes, my husband died last year. And there's a great deal I know only through going through that experience. So it's about as big a thing as can happen to you. And his effect on my thinking and my understanding is pervasive. And it helped me understand how Nurbanu might be as her, you know, as she gets more ill.
So what I'm kind of getting from you is the sense that you've had an experience where you had to look back on your life with somebody else who is now gone. Just as Nurbanu is now at the cusp of her own passing, is looking back on her life and the people she's lived it with.
That's right. I wouldn't trade being the age I am for anything. I guess that's sort of a response to what you're saying. And she wouldn't either. She gets this, that she's glad to know what she knows. And she's particularly glad to know what she has figured out over the course of the 30 days, because she's finally been truthful with herself. And honestly, I don't think that kind of truthfulness, well, I'm not going to say it's not available to young people, but you know, young people aren't really prompted to kind of drill way down. Why would you want to? It's very painful. And, you know, you kind of don't need to when you're younger. But when you're older, there's a logic to doing that. And I have felt it, and I felt it along with her. When I began the book, I had this goal, well, sort of goal, of finishing it by the time I was the age she was when she actually died, right? I started when I was 47. She dies when she's 58. I blow through her 50, you know, my 58th birthday, I blow through 60 through 65, you know. And I thought, well, I guess she's just going to have to wait for me. And she did.
And it's a terrific book and really a fascinating one for the picture that it affords us into a remarkable woman in a remarkable time. Catherine Nouri Hughes, I want to thank you so much for talking with us about The Mapmaker's Daughter and coming on to Writer's Voice.
It's been a great pleasure for me. Thank you so much, Francesca.
Catherine Nouri Hughes. You can read excerpts from The Mapmaker's Daughter by going to writersvoice.net. Next up, how to promote your book. Do you know what a book publicist does? Well, if you've written or plan to write a book, you should. If you're self-published, promoting your book is entirely up to you. But even if a bona fide publishing house is handling your book, you're unlikely to get much support for promotion unless you're already a well-known writer. So that's why Claire McKinney decided to share her more than 15 years of experience as a book publicist in her book, Do You Know What a Book Publicist Does? A Guide for Creating Your Own Campaigns. Claire McKinney is the CEO and founder of Claire McKinney PR, based in New Jersey. Well, Claire McKinney, welcome to Writer's Voice.
Thank you. It's nice to be talking to you.
You have been a long time in book publishing, in publicity for book publishing. Given all this explosion of digital media and social media, do you think it's harder or easier to sell a book these days?
I think that there are more opportunities to sell a book. I think that it's easier to sell a lot more books in a lot of ways, but not in as big numbers as they used to. The digital media has made it possible for all kinds of people and small presses to market their books and reach readers directly. And that's something that traditional publishers haven't been as successful doing over the years. It's not something they ever really focused on. Everything that they did was trade marketing. So for people who are mid-list or indie authors, it's offered a great potential and resource for people to sell books, but it's almost like hand selling. It's almost like you were, you know, parked at the side of the street selling it out of the trunk of your car. It's a slow build, is kind of how it often goes with a lot of people.
And also, I just wonder if you could talk about the difference between traditional publishing and self-publishing, because I remember when I started the show in 2004, and self-publishing was really looked down upon. And my sense is that that's changed a bit. Is that right?
I think it has. I mean, I think, you know, when I first started working on my own and was working, that was in 2009. So it was sort of just in the beginnings of all of the self-publishing craze. And I thought that I could use a lot of the same approaches and a lot of the same media outlets to push the books as I did with the traditional books. But that wasn't necessarily possible, because the bottom line was that the New York Times, the USA Today, places like that, they just don't review self-published books. You know, they have a rule about it. So I had to find, you know, other ways around it, and that's when I started to really dig into the whole idea of the direct-to-consumer reach and using the internet, not just through publicity purposes, but also, you know, social media and, you know, content marketing and all those things. I mean, the main difference is, and you need to be, you know, with a big brand that's recognized. If you're with a traditional house and you have, you know, that name on the spine that's recognized by reviewers and people who cover books, then that gives you a leg up as compared to somebody who is not represented by a big house. But if you are part of any publishing house, any small press that doesn't have clout, and I mean, there are some small presses like Algonquin that is a recognized name as far as a smaller press is concerned. So that's, you know, safer as far as getting attention from traditional outlets. But almost everybody else is not going to have, it's just not going to get covered by the mainstream outlets that everybody wants. There just isn't enough space and, you know, there just isn't enough time for those people to cover those books. So the difference is that there's a whole world of other outlets and places and niches and areas where you can try to promote the book. It's just that it's not as easy as going, you know, like for me, going into my database and saying book review editor and pulling up a list and saying, oh, great, you know, I can send this to so-and-so at the New York Times. I can send this to so-and-so. You know, it's just not as easy as that.
And my sense has always been that, you know, the self-publishing is a lot easier if it's a how-to book, but you actually talk in your book, Claire McKinney, you talk in Do You Know What a Book Publicist Does, about people who are writing fiction. So I wonder if you could address the differences in that kind of, let's say, artisanal marketing.
Right. Well, that's the thing. You know, what I've realized as far as, well, the fiction reviewers, they started to dry up in the early 2000s, probably around the time that you started your show, when the publishing industry and journalism and everything started to implode, and it just got worse. So the amount of outlets to review fiction was diminishing rapidly at that point. And when I started my own business, I devoted a lot of time to looking for the outlets that still reviewed fiction, looking for the people online that were influential with fiction, and putting them in the categories that were appropriate, whether they reviewed mysteries, you know, genre stuff, or if they reviewed literary books. So finding those outlets has helped a lot of the authors we've worked with. And then the other thing is, this is something that I have always done, but it's become even more important in this, you know, very competitive age, is to look for the angles in the books that are potentially promotable off the book page, so that you can go and, you know, try, if you have something that's set in Montana in the mountains, then maybe the local Montana press might be interested. It may cover it. Somebody out there might want to cover it because it's relevant to them. So looking for those angles that would get you something outside of the regular day-to-day. So we had this author, and he's in my book, Richard Van Anderson. We worked on his first installment in a thriller series, and he was a cardiothoracic surgeon in his previous life. And we took his medical background and used it to get him some broadcast interviews under the angle or idea of, you know, somebody putting real information about operations and, you know, from experience, a doctor being able to pull on his, you know, vast knowledge in the operating room to write a really grisly, you know, meaty book. And we were able to book him on a television program in Portland in conjunction with the Left Coast Crime Series, which is a conference that happens every year on the West Coast. And, you know, that was very exciting because they took him because of his medical background, but they talked to him about how he managed to use that and to write his book. So that's an example of something, finding those nonfiction angles that then making them work. It doesn't always work, but it's part of the strategy of promoting a book at this point, especially fiction.
Yeah, and I assume that that would work for memoir and history and things of that kind as well, and other nonfiction books, not just how-to books.
Oh, yeah. I mean, literary or narrative nonfiction, certainly looking for those people and areas that have interest in covering the subject matter or the location or a character. You know, if you have somebody, say, you know, Thomas Jefferson is represented in your book, I mean, that's a really big name, of course, but you can go online and look for references to Thomas Jefferson in the news and see if there are recent ones, and there probably are because there are plenty of outlets, so there probably are. And then you can go to the people who are associated with those publications and say, hello, you know, I've got this book I wrote. It's about, you know, Thomas Jefferson's ride in a covered wagon to the prairie where he started a bank, you know, or whatever. You know, that's not true, obviously, but say that's the book. I mean, that's what you do.
If you've just joined Writer's Voice, we're talking with Claire McKinney. She is a book publicist and has her own publicity firm, Claire McKinney PR. Her book is Do You Know What a Book Publicist Does? A Guide for Creating Your Own Campaigns. And it is terrific. It is very, very clear, very well laid out. So, you know, people obviously begin not being known. Most people writing books are probably not known. How do you present yourself? What are the important things about presenting yourself and telling people who you are in a way that can spark their interest?
How you get people interested is to look for the things, well, first of all, your credentials, whatever education you've had, whatever experience you have in the field that you're in, which you're writing, or if it's, you know, a novel, do you have an MFA? Where's it from? If you don't, you know, like what experiences do you have that relate back to what you've written? You know, really, it's part of it is credentials and expertise and personal experience and personal story. So, you know, people are always looking for a really good personal story, but it's not something that gets out there always right away. Every personal story that's really great doesn't end up in People magazine right away. So you have to find people, most likely you're going to find things in the online community or in your local papers and things that will take a chance on covering you and what you have to say or what your story is, because they can afford to, because they're smaller. They don't have to worry about the readership and advertising dollars that a People magazine would have to worry about.
If you've just joined Writer's Voice, we're talking with book publicist Claire McKinney about her book, Do you know what a book publicist does? A guide for creating your own campaigns. And what about using social media and, well, and maybe they're two different things, niche marketing, but I think there's a connection between social media and niche marketing.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, because social media is about targeting your, it's about a couple of things. One is targeting your message to specific groups or trying to get into a conversation about a topic that relates back to you and what you're trying to get out there. And the other thing that social media is about is building relationships. So the social media, you're able to look for people either, you know, through using hashtags or by searching, you know, on some of the major sites for people who are talking about or interested in some of the topics that you would bring to the table as a writer and through your book. The thing about social media use that I tell people when I speak is if not everybody's going to be good at it and not everybody's going to like to do it. If you really hate the idea of doing it, then I tell people don't because it's not going to be helpful. It's not a good idea to create a bunch of social media platforms and then just have them sitting out there dormant because one thing that people do look at when they look you up is they'll go to your site or your Facebook page or whatnot and see when the last time was that you posted. And if you haven't posted in 6 months or a year, people don't like that. So that's one thing I tell people. The second thing is if you do see yourself as getting involved in social media, look at the platforms that make the most sense for what it is that you're trying to sell. So if you're a novelist, you know, Facebook is probably a good place for you, especially if you're doing women's fiction, Facebook is good. If you have something that has a lot of potential graphics associated with it or, you know, pictures, we have a mystery author who has a lot of fun pictures and, you know, recipes sometimes and things like that. And so, you know, she has a Pinterest page too and boards that she posts things on because people love to look at Pinterest. And that's a market that is, you know, women primarily of all ages, but, you know, mainly in that 25 to 64 demographic, which is the biggest, that's the demographic that buys the most stuff in general. So you look at the platforms that you think that you would want to be involved in working with, and then you learn how to work on them, whether it's through somebody helping you or by getting a book in the library or just by getting on there and playing until you get more comfortable. But social media, it can be very useful. But if you aren't using it correctly, you don't have to be perfect. But if you aren't using it in the manner in which it was intended, then it's not going to do what you need it to do, and it's going to be a waste of your time.
Now, we should be clear here that we're not just talking about people who are self-publishing or even necessarily publishing with a tiny little publishing house. I have heard from a lot of authors that have been handled, you know, by big mm-hmm. publishing houses, you know, the ones you'd recognize, St. Martin's Press or other ones, mm-hmm. that if they're not well-known, they don't really get a whole lot of bandwidth from their publisher, and that, in fact, it's up to them to do a lot of the publicity. Is that correct?
Yeah, I mean, it is correct. In a lot of cases, publicity departments have, in general, marketing departments and publicity departments in publishing have shrunk in size. For the time that I was working in-house, the people started to feel that because there were fewer book review outlets or book outlets, specific book outlets, that meant that you needed less people. There wasn't as much work to do. My argument has always been that there's even more work to do because now you have to really find places. You know, you have to really work at it. So the departments have shrunk. And so, yes, I mean, a lot of big authors have publicists in addition to whatever their in-house person is doing in the publishing house. The social media aspect almost always falls to the author to either hire a person or do it on their own because the publishing house just doesn't have the bandwidth. They don't have enough people, and it's labor-intensive. You know, all this stuff takes time. And one way to think of it as an author is think about how much you're getting paid for your book. You may think that $50,000 is a lot to get paid for a book, but from a publisher's perspective, that's not a ton. And so their marketing budget probably isn't not $100,000, let's just put it that way. And if it's not that, then, you know, you're going to be getting less time and money is going to be spent on what you're giving them than on somebody who they've paid $1 million for.
Now, finally, what about Amazon? Is it good or bad for authors?
That's an interesting question, because Amazon has helped a lot of people gain ground in the book world from self-publishing and indie publishing perspective. Amazon has been very helpful to a lot of people. And in fact, I was working with a Canadian publisher for a while, and they were distributing in the U.S., and I used to say to them, you know, why don't you just sell on Amazon? Because Barnes & Noble is taking so few of your books that it almost doesn't matter that they have them in the store because nobody can find them. I was only half serious. But regardless, Amazon has helped a lot of those people. With the bigger authors, you know, Amazon can drive a lot of pre-orders and pre-sales, which people like because that can help you get your numbers up for the bestsellers list. But they're always changing their algorithms, and so you never know how long that actually is going to work or if it works sometimes but not other times. And bookstores take the bigger authors' books, and publishers pay for marketing co-op and get the books in the fronts of the stores, and they come up with special promotions for them. So, you know, in that case, Amazon, is it helping? Well, it's probably, I don't know what the percentage is these days. When I left and working in-house, it was in 2009, Amazon represented 5% of your overall sales. Now I would probably say it probably represents 20% for a traditional published author, because that used to be what Barnes & Noble represented. And then I think that it's probably somewhat flipped, although not to the degree of, I think Barnes & Noble probably sells more than 5% of your overall sales. But regardless, it's not an easy question to answer because it depends on how you're publishing and who you are. If you have no name recognition and your books are not in bookstores, then you absolutely need Amazon. If you are somebody who gets the books into the bookstores and you have name recognition, you know, Amazon, it may drive sales initially, but for the long run, I don't know. You know, do you need them? Maybe, but I'm not sure. I'd have to see the numbers to know.
Well, this has been such an interesting conversation. Claire McKinney, your book is Do You Know What a Book Publicist Does? A Guide for Creating Your Own Campaigns. Thank you so much for talking with us here.
Oh, thank you. It's been lovely.
Book publicist Claire McKinney. You can find more tips from McKinney about promoting your book by going to writersvoice.net. That's it this week for Writer's Voice. Go to writersvoice.net to listen to or download past shows, plus find out more about our guests or read book excerpts. You can also sign up to get the show delivered straight to your inbox or subscribe to the podcast and the newsletter. And follow us on Twitter at Writer's Voice, all one word. The Writer's Voice webmaster is Bill Way. I'm your host, Francesca Rhiannon.